Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. You know, one of the nice things about Action Radio is we get to really dissect a subject. We get to spend, you know, all our time. You'll notice that every show has a title. Every show has a theme, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more, depending on what's going on. But the whole idea is I really like to cover things in more than just, you know, two-minute sound bites or the usual stuff you get, you know, on the news. And so today we're really going to go over Mike Milley, the Massachusetts liberal Marxist general who happens to be in charge of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. How little power that actually is. It's an advisory position. There's no chain of command. And so I've been listening to a lot of things. I've been watching stuff. I've got about five major articles that I'm probably going to go over today and some time with, and we shall see what's happening there. But there's just a lot to talk about. But I had an idea. I want to get Gene on the line here, Gene, our producer, who I think is we're on phone today. We're still working on some technical difficulties with our site here to get Jean fully up and running so she can do the live chat and everything else that's going on here. But behind the scenes is doing all kinds of stuff, research stuff, and you know, it's just there's just so much that makes this show go. It's really exciting. Jean, how are you doing this morning? How's life?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Oh, I'm having a great time. I have an idea, though. I have to run this by before I even get started. You know, I like sometimes the lighter moments, you know, of Action Radio. It's raining outside. Well, I think it stopped now, but you've been here. You know how much it can rain in Florida. It rains a lot in Florida. And if it weren't for the fact that our soil is like a sieve, the water just drains into the groundwater and off it goes. I'm not sure where it goes. Probably ends up a lot of it in the Gulf of Mexico. But I had an idea. I was thinking that California, the federal government and the socialist federal government and the Marxist government of California, that incidentally just got reelected, you know, or just got avoided their recall. What a surprise. Mail-in ballots, no recall. See if you can make a connection, okay? Anyway, so I was thinking that the farmers are being dehydrated. they're being starved for water. They're taking the 30 feet of snowpack, the billions upon billions of gallons of water that falls in snow in the Sierras, and they're sending it out the Golden Gate into the Pacific Ocean, which already has enough water. Thank you very much. Also, that One American News is reporting that the water that supposedly goes to help the fish isn't helping the fish. The fish have plenty of water, too, apparently. So it's just total waste. So I was thinking, if Florida captured some of the rainwater here and just sent it to Florida, what do you think? That would be a kick.
I think that'd be hysterical. California, that would be, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this about 2 minutes before showtime. I thought, wouldn't that be some, I don't know if we should sell it or just give it there as like a political gesture. You know, but in fact, maybe you could work out like a water for food deal. So in other words, we send them water and they send us back food in an exchange program, and they would sell directly to Floridians cheaply in exchange for cheap water that their own state refuses to give them. I think there's something to this, and this is where I really wish I had, you know, contact with a governor. I could just call up DeSantis and say, "Hey, Ronnie, dude, I got an idea for you," because you know that's how we do ideas. You know, I mean, Matt Gaetz didn't call Action Radio the Ideas Factory for nothing, but that's my latest one this morning, and this is why we have to get big. We have to get bigger faster because you know, we need these connections to be able to go right to the source and say, hey, we've got an idea, water for food for California. Anyway, if you have any other, I'm curious, any further reaction to that, let me know. Or if you have, you know, more expansive things we should be doing with this program, I think we could actually start something here. What do you think?
You know, that would work, but I don't know if the governor of California would even approve it.
I'm not asking for his approval. I'm not asking for the governor of California's approval.
No,
this is a private deal with the farmers.
If you bring water in there, you don't have to go through him, but technically it would be the nice thing to do.
Name one thing about Gavin Newsom that would engender the nice thing to do. The man who just probably stole a recall with vote fraud.
what possible nice thing?
You're dealing with Marxists here. Nice is not a word I would ever use in connection with Marxists. Force is a word I would use with Marxists, but political force, not you know, arms and things like that, unless they, you know, shoot first. But we're not there. Hopefully we'll never get there. But Action Radio is a political force, obviously. I mean, the whole idea is to generate millions upon millions of citizen legislators and legislative supporters that like our legislation better than what's going on in Congress and the state legislatures, because I think our stuff is better because it's written by people for people. So in that respect, you know, our whole point here is to get stuff out there. And that is force. I mean, the lobbying is force. Nice force. You know, big smiles on our faces. But the fact is, if we have millions of voters behind us, you know, we're going to have some real impact out there. We will change the national debate. So no, I'm not planning to. In fact, that never entered my mind to contact. It's a good point though, but it never entered my mind to contact the governor of California, because the farmers can contract with you know, Florida directly. Now, would the governor want to get involved with that? Oh sure. I mean, ideally, they will direct the snowpack, so we don't have to do it. But I think it's like war. You prepare for it, so you don't have to fight it. I think if we are prepared to send California farmers, you know, a gazillion gallons of water that would otherwise wash into the ground and disappear, you know, in Florida, why not? I mean, water's water. Water's conserved. We're not, the earth is not creating new water. It's not losing water. It's just kind of moving around, you know, whether it's in the sky as water vapor, whether it's underground in aquifers, whether it's in the oceans as salt water, which is useless to anybody except, you know, fish and things that live in it, which is fine with them. We need them. And it's, you know, the oceans generate a lot of our oxygen. But as far as it goes, you know, we're not losing water in the grand scheme of things if we take water from here and ship it there, especially if we have enough for our own agriculture. Excess could be shipped, sold, pipelined. Has there been a water pipeline? I never expected to go here this morning, folks. So how about a water pipeline? What if we have a direct water pipeline to California farmers from Florida? Ooh. And if it leaks, who cares? It's water. What does it matter? Are you thinking what I'm thinking? This could be fun. I'll have to propose this. I have to make it. All right, so this is going to be a bill. I'm going to send it to the governor. I do have a contact there who's never written me back, by the way, so I'm not going to say who it is. But I think this would be fascinating fun. All right. Let's see if we can get your computer working. Give it a try. See what you can do today, and try some things out. And we're going to – if folks are wondering, you know, why is it taking Gene, you know, a long time to get this worked out? Look, it takes everybody. If you go back to my original shows, the mistakes I made, the shows I cut off accidentally, you know, the times I was broadcasting when I wasn't. You know, I mean, our first shows were pretty disastrous, but that's how it starts, okay? I mean, everybody that's come onto the show with a microphone, trying to coordinate that with your computer, it's a new experience because you're not in a studio, you don't have somebody to help you, you kind of have to figure it out on your own, so these things take time. Okay, let me do a quick thing here. Actually, let me play something. I've got to play more of our stuff here because we have some. I don't get to play my stuff enough because I talk too much. And so let me play this, and this is quick. This is fun, too.
Radio, dangerously cool.
Yeah, see, I love stuff like that. So that should wake you up. I want to talk about briefly here our new webmaster, Eric Cawley. That's E-R-I-C-C-A-W-L-E-Y. He's been invaluable in helping us at Action Radio with our sites at writeyourlaws.com. That's W-R-I-T-E-Y-O-U-R-L-A-W-S, writeyourlaws.com. And so let me just tell you a bit about him. And he's got a business card which he gave us, and I want to be able to share some of the information with you. He says, to help you with your small business marketing, Eric Cawley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, there we go, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. So if you want to get in touch with Eric, our webmaster, and just genius. I mean, I work with him personally. He's an amazing person to work with. So this is a recommendation here, you know, directly from Action Radio to you. Phone number 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. If you miss it, we're going to be podcasting in about 2 hours. Email eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's eric@BESS, just like it sounds like. And that's the website too, besmallbusiness.com. All right, let's talk about the lovely and talented General Milley, shall we? Let's see if we can get Gene. All right, Gene, can you activate your line, or do you want me to do it? Oh, you can't tell me. there we go. Okay, so you have the control, as they say.
I've now got my computer that I can hear out of. Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so
that's what
I'm going to let you push buttons and screen calls and play something too if you want. Today I'm going to do your hotel bell. I promise. I mean, it's on my list of things to do. All right, so I'm off today. I'm off the day job. So I'm going to play with the production things. I've got many production things to do. So I got a couple of themes that are long overdue. I'll see if I can crank those up. Plus our new founding moments. So we're going to have, I'm going to try and limit them to 5 minutes. So that's my next project because I don't need to talk as much as I'm doing. So we'll get those down a little bit too. The last one was the Articles of Confederation Part 2. And this week I'm going to cover Federalist Number 5. All right, let's talk about the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this comes directly from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, jcs.mil/about/. So that's Joint Chiefs. This is their own information from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It says the Joint Chiefs of Staff consists of the chairman, that would be the lovely and talented Mark Milley, the vice chairman, the chief of staff of the Army, chief of staff, chief of naval operations, the chief of staff of the Air Force, the commandant of the Marine Corps. I wonder how the Marines got the name commandant. We'll have to investigate that too. That's kind of curious. The chief of the National Guard Bureau. I didn't know the National Guard was a bureau. And the chief of space operations. That would be the Space Force. We need like a big echo. That's nothing. You get an echo chamber. Joe Pag says that all the time. He says, you know, whenever he says racism, it's like racism. This great, echo thing. We'll work on that. Anyway, the information is the collective body of the JCS. That's Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'll just call them JCS because they do. The collective body of the JCS is headed by the chairman or the vice chairman in the chairman's absence, who sets the agenda and presides over JCS meetings. Responsibilities as members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff take precedence over duties as the chiefs of the military services. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is the principal military advisor to the president. Let me say that again. Principal military advisor to the president, and then the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Council. However, all JCS members are by law military advisors, and they may respond to a request or voluntarily submit through the chairman advice or opinions to the president, the Secretary of Defense, or the National Security Council. Here's where it gets interesting. The executive authority of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has changed. In World War II, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff acted as executive agents in dealing with theater area and area commanders. Okay, so theater, when they talk about the military is fascinating. You know, they talk about a tour of duty. That's how you go into combat, okay, but they call it a tour, all right? You know, George Carlin would be proud of this. You don't go to a combat zone. You go to a theater. Okay, so I don't know how they do this, but the military is their own way of sort of defining these things. So theater would be like the European theater in World War II would be fighting Hitler and Nazi Germany. The Pacific theater would be fighting, you know, Hirohito, the Emperor of Japan, and the Empire of Japan. Those would be theaters. So that's what they're talking about here. All right. So executive agents in dealing with theater and area commanders. But the original National Security Act of 1947, that's what I think created the CIA, National Security Act of 1947 saw the Joint Chiefs of Staff as planners and advisors. Now, here's the key, not as commanders or combatant commands. Of combatant commands. So they were not as commanders of combatant commands. In spite of this, the 1948 Key West Agreement allowed members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to serve as executive agents for unified commands, a responsibility that allowed the executive agent to originate direct communication with the combatant command. In other words, they were commanding the combatants. Okay. Congress abolished this authority in a 1953 amendment to the National Security Act. All right. Today, the Joint Chiefs of Staff have no executive authority to command combatant forces. Let me read that again. The Joint Chiefs of Staff have no executive authority to command combatant forces. All right. Now, contrast that with what Milley's doing, you know, screwing up Afghanistan, talking to General Lee in China. I'm going to find out. I hear he's a real bastard. I'm going to find out more about him. But the fact that Milley is communicating with them and talking about, we'll get into that. I've got like five articles on this guy today. And so it's going to be an interesting, sort of wading into the very mysterious world of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's our job, I believe, for today. Anyway, it says Congress abolished this authority. I'm losing my place here. Okay. No authority. Okay. The issue of executive authority was clearly resolved by the Goldwater-Nichols Department of Defense Reorganization Act of 1986. Okay. This is too many big words for me this morning. All right, I'm getting it's Monday. All right. Too many big words. All right. So that's why I'm going to get messed up here. But here's the quote. The secretaries of the military departments shall assign all forces under their jurisdiction to unified and specified combatant commands to perform missions assigned to those commands. the chain of command runs here. This is the other key. All right. Now, I've heard this quote on the news before. Besides the fact that they have no executive authority to command combatant forces, that's forces in combat, right? The chain of command, here's the quote, runs from the president to the Secretary of Defense and from the Secretary of Defense to the commander of the combatant command. Okay. You'll notice the Joint Chiefs of Staff are not in the loop. They are not there for combat. They are not there for nuclear weapons. They are not there for any real operation. They are advisors. They take all the information. You know, they're an independent, allegedly independent advisory group to the president. That's their job. Are they doing their job under Milley, you know, the Marxist from Massachusetts? You know, no, not at all. He's completely abdicated his duty and has run off on his own. He's a rogue general. If anybody remembers the film 7 Days in May, Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. Burt Lancaster is the bad guy. Kirk Douglas is the good guy. Gene, if you can come back on here for a second. Do you remember this film? It was like either, I think, 50s, late 50s, 60s. You know, it's fascinating that the films that were made in the 50s, 60s, and 70s warned us all about the things that are happening today. Okay? So 7 Days in May. Do you remember it? Did you ever see it, Gene?
I don't think I've ever seen it because I would remember that. Yeah, no.
You need to.
I will have
everybody,
to, yeah.
Everybody needs to watch it because it's basically right now of Mark Milley. You know, Mark Milley, who thought he was, you know, president, who thought he could advise China, who thought he could, you know, say that Trump, you know, Trump's not stable, but we are stable under me. You know, this is who this guy is. And it was an attempt by a general. I won't give away the whole plot because it's really a great movie. Frederick March plays the president and brilliantly, too. He was also the one that played William Jennings Bryan in the film Inherit the Wind, which is a blatantly leftist interpretation of the Scopes Monkey Trial, which was the evolution trial in Tennessee. And Spencer Tracy played Clarence Darrow. Fabulous film to watch those two, because they're absolute giants of the cinema. But you have to take into account the bias, you know, it's fascinating how they did the portrayal. Anyway, so Frederick March plays the president. Burt Lancaster is the rogue general. And Kirk Douglas is the colonel that discovers all this and says, "General, you can't do this." "Yes, I can." "No, you can't." And he has to go to the president. I won't give away the whole plot, but it is a fabulous film and a look insight into the military and how much power they have, which is further convincing me that the greatest danger we face is our bureaucracies. Okay, and that will include Congress, the Pentagon, the various agencies like the Justice Department, the EPA. You know, various other folks. Oh, here's another one, Gene. I heard this on the news this morning too. The Chevy Volt, the electric car. They say don't charge it overnight in your garage. It'll probably catch fire. Well, not probably, but they say it may. I think that's what they say. So they're advising don't charge it overnight and park it 50 feet away from any other car.
Oh,
who's got 50 feet in an urban area from another car? Give me a break. Have you seen San Francisco? They're parking like 6 inches apart. They park by Braille. You bump the cars around you to make a space. Literally, that's what they do. Okay.
Yeah, and I heard something over the weekend that people that and I'm good get you know you want to you know watch our natural resources you know cut down on litter all that stuff whatever but mm-hmm. from when you have a battery operated car it takes 7 years more than a regular car with fossil fuel as far as the amount of damage it does to the environment
mm-hmm.
and. It's like, where do they think the batteries go? And then where do they think the batteries, how do they get charged up? Where does that come from?
Mm-hmm.
Electric doesn't come from the sky. So it's like, how, it's just insane.
Nope, you're breaking up a little bit.
That's another whole pad tangent.
Yeah. So you're breaking a bit. So little Radio 101 folks, or if you're listening, if you want to do your own podcast, I would back away from your mic slightly and turn your gain down a little bit, just a bit. It's amazing how much power these microphones have. I used to be up next to the microphone. I'm at least 4 or 5 inches away from it now. And that's how I stopped. And it took me months to figure this out. But these things are powerful. And so give that a shot because I don't want to miss anything. I don't want anybody to miss words because that was driving me nuts our first year of operation. Okay, so yeah, and here's the question too on these electric cars. You know, how much of this is recyclable? I mean, are the battery parts recyclable or do they burn out and they're gone? You know,
and they don't last that long.
That's another problem. Well, I hear there's some new battery technology coming, which will be great. But the biggest problem is that the problem with electric cars is that they run on electricity. People don't realize that. They think, well, it's zero polluting. Oh, really? What do you think powers your power plants, folks? You know, we've talked about this before. Coal, oil, natural gas, or nuclear. Those are your choices right now. There is some hydro. There is some geothermal. There is some wind, but they're not enough. You know, not even close to enough, you know, to power the electric power grid and be a reliable source of power. So that's what you're looking at. All right, last word on that, and then I wanted to get on to the Dr. Price article before he gets here. We got about 10 minutes for that.
You can go on to the article, yeah.
Okay, sounds cool. All right, so I post this on my Facebook page and on the Action Radio group. Action Radio group is for the public. My Facebook page is for my friends, simply because trolls out there took over my page and tried to cancel me out. And so guess what? It didn't work. Okay, I'm still here. All right. So this is from the Center for Security Policy. This is September 17th. So today is what, the 20th? Yeah, so this is 3 days ago. It's from Dr. Peter Pry, who's going to be with us in about 9 minutes. All right. So his article is How to Start an Accidental Nuclear War. And I love this article. It's got these missiles on the cover, the big radioactive sign. It's Dr. Pry at his best. All right. So anyway, he's a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. This guy has more qualifications. I mean, it was such a pleasure to have him here. And I'm constantly amazed that one of Washington's brightest people agree or disagree with him. You know, he is absolute genius, and he knows his stuff. Okay. And I do disagree with him, too, because I think he really gets, you know, he pushes the envelope as far as some of the war stuff goes. All right. Let me get to his article because it concerns General Milley, which is why I brought it up. He says, suppose a hostile, confrontational neighbor, angry with you for years over seemingly everything, ranging from borrowed money to property boundaries, called you in the middle of the night to say, quote, don't worry, I don't plan to kill you. If I do come to murder you, I will warn you first. What would you do? A, go back to sleep. B, call the police. C, prepare to defend yourself. If you are a normal person, you would probably call the police and prepare to defend yourself. If you are communist China and you receive such a call from the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark A. Milley, you would probably be alert Chairman Xi, Xi Jinping, and other political military leaders of the PRC, People's Republic of China, and see mobilized nuclear and conventional forces to defend yourself. If you're a communist China, depending on how seriously you regard General Milley, you might also at least consider D, launching a preemptive nuclear strike to kill General Milley and the United States before they kill you. Okay, this is why I say, Dr. Pry, he doesn't, you know, he's not wishy-washy about what he believes. He says, according to the new book, Peril, by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, something like the above actually happened, but in their telling, President Trump is supposed to be the bad guy and General Milley the hero. Yeah, you'll hear that on CNN, a lot of other places. They're totally reversing, you know, what really happened to fit their narrative, because, you know, Trump's all bad and everybody else is all good, and it's just the opposite. He says, reportedly, Peril, co-authored by Robert Costa, said General Milley became so concerned about Mr. Trump's mental state that he assembled senior military advisors and advised them not to carry out a presidential order to launch a nuclear strike unless he was there. Let me go over that again. Mr. Trump's mental state that he, that would be General Milley, assembled senior military leaders and advised them not carry out a presidential order to launch a nuclear strike unless he was there. Bear in mind, I just told you from the Joint Chiefs of Staff own material that there is no chain of command for the Joint Chiefs. They're advisors only. They have no executive authority. What he did right there, you know, could be pretty treasonous. At least, at the very least, it's highly illegal. Grounds for not only removal from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but his court-martial as a general. Just for that, just for calling that meeting. Because he couldn't even do that. And that's the tip of the iceberg. It gets worse. He says, allegedly, this is back to the article by Peter Pry. Allegedly, on October 30th, General Milley called his counterpart in China, General Li Zhongshen, and I don't care if I pronounce his name right. He's a communist general. Supposedly to reassure China's top general command of the People's Liberation Army that the U.S. had no immediate plans to make a surprise nuclear strike or other attack on China. Now, isn't that special? Isn't that special? You know, should we have warned, you know, Saddam Hussein, hey, guess what? We're coming. Well, of course, they probably knew. They saw the buildup. But the point is, you don't do that. They say he warned his counterpart. I want to know how he even knew exactly who his counterpart was. Worse than that, I want to know how he knew how to get in contact with his counterpart. What, did they exchange phone numbers? Are they on Facebook together? What is this? How does he know this general well enough to call him up and say, yep, if we're going to attack, well, I'll let you know ahead of time. What a traitorous bastard this guy is. I'm talking about Milley. I mean, Li Zhongcheng, I'm sure, is a loyal Chinese officer of the Chinese Communist Party, but I hear he's pretty much a bastard, too. So you've got one bastard calling another bastard. except that one's, you know, serving his country and the other one is, yeah, guess which one isn't? General Milley. All right. Anyway, so he says, General Lee, if you and I have known each other now for 5 years, if we're going to attack, I'm going to call you ahead of time. It's not going to be a surprise. That'd be like, you know, Japan before Pearl Harbor, you know, calling up George Marshall, head of the then Joint Chiefs, and saying, you know, having like a Japan, like Yamamoto saying, "Get out, we're coming." it's that. It's that traitors, which would be traitors to Japan at the time. Of course, it would have been good for us. Anyway, he says, back to the article. Allegedly, on January 8th, 2 days after protesters occupied the U.S. Capitol, well, at least he says it the right way, protesters, well, I wouldn't even say occupied. And I wouldn't say, you know, they were Trump's, well, we'll go into that later. And that's January 6th. General Milley called General Lee supposedly to again reassure him that the U.S. was not heading toward anarchy that could result in a nuclear surprise attack on China. Things may look unsteady, is the quote, but that's the nature of democracy. General Lee, we are 100% steady. Now, this is a theme that you'll see in the articles in the second hour. You know, Milley keeps talking about us being steady. You know, we're stable, with the implication that Trump is unstable. But I would say just the opposite. This guy is unstable. This guy is assuming powers he does not have. This guy is calling people he should not be calling. This guy is directing meetings he has no business directing. This is the guy who is unstable. He doesn't know his job. He doesn't know his place in the military. He doesn't know his job title, and he doesn't care. He's building a little empire there in the military. He's being a Defense Department unto himself. You know, he's doing exactly, like I say, if you look at 7 days in May, where that general, you know, Burt Lancaster, actually tries to take over the country and create a military dictatorship here, okay? And that takes place over 7 days. We've been dealing with this crap for years now of people undermining the Trump administration. And it's fascinating. There was an amazing quote that came out, I forgot who said it. I think it was actually Eric Trump. Eric Trump, son of Donald Trump, was on, I think, Sunday Morning Futures with Maria Bartiromo. He says, every time the Democrats, you know, dig down into a scandal, they find themselves. Okay? I think that's very prophetic and it's very true. It's projection. You know, what if you want to know what Democrats are doing, look what they accuse you of. Okay? It's the same kind of thing. You know, when this guy talks about, when General Milley talks about the U.S. as being unstable, he really means himself. You know, so projection is the definition of American Marxists. Everything they do is projection. Everything they do seems to be is to blame other people for what they are and still call it illegal, which is, I guess, cognitive dissonance. You know, it's one of those terms I've never really been adequately to get a hold of. Anyway, we got to Dr. Pryor coming in probably about 2 minutes. Let me get through more of this. He says, allegedly on January 8th, 2 days after I read that part. Peril, this is back to Woodward and Costa, are no fans of President Trump. They have a history of propagandizing, and their story clearly fits the left-wing media's unending campaign to discredit Trump and convince Trump voters they made a mistake. Because we're convinced they're just the opposite. Sorry, guys, it's not working. Back to the article. However, General Milley and his spokesman, Colonel David Butler, I don't know who that is, issued a classic Washington non-denial denial that appears to confirm that the Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman called General Lee to tell him a U.S. surprise nuclear attack was not imminent. Quote, his calls with the Chinese and others in October and January were in keeping with these duties and responsibilities, conveying reassurance in order to maintain strategic stability. See, there's that word again, stability. So stability, I'm defining for these people as you know, the deep state, as the way it's been, as business as usual, where the United States gets screwed, we pay for all the defense of Europe, you know, we lose our jobs to China. China takes all our technology. That's steady. As far as they're concerned, that's the – and we head for a Marxist dictatorship in the United States, you know, so we can join the rest of the world's Marxist dictatorships. That's what they think of as stable. I really believe that. Gene, what do you think? Think I'm onto something here?
Oh, very true. Very true.
Yeah.
But the sad thing – well, I got to believe justice will eventually be served. But the way it's going, it's questionable.
How?
Because it seems like – when the Democrats do anything, it's always pushed under the rug, or like you said, it's they portray it as a Republican or someone else doing it and not them. But the bottom line is he should be charged with treason, or he should be kicked out, no retirement, and Pelosi should be kicked out, no retirement, for what she did. She should be going behind the back of the American people. That is not her job either.
Whoop, you just cut out for the last little bit there. But yeah, and as far as Pelosi goes, absolutely. And because Pelosi and Milley made a deal together, and that's something, I don't know if that's covered, I think that's going to be in the articles. I don't know. I got to kind of go over this. It's hard to keep in mind everything they talk about because there's a lot. There's a lot that's going on there. So Dr. Price on the line now. He gets to listen to the last paragraph, last little bit of his. Actually, I've got a little bit more to go than I thought. Well, let me bring him on. I'll let him tell the story. Dr. Pryor, we got through, I guess, about 2/3 of your article here on the show this morning. And so let's do something real quick. Let's get this going here. Got to scroll down here. I was right happily enjoying this article because it's so amazing what Dr. Pryor is talking about. All right, be right back. What is national security? How much is enough? What about the cost? What are our adversaries doing? Who wins between the State Department and the Pentagon? How accurate is our intelligence capability? Are we keeping up with our nuclear deterrent? Do we have better weapons than our adversaries? How would we know? Can we withstand an EMP attack? How is our missile defense? How about the basic power grid? Is it safe? These are the questions Dr. Pry has been dealing with his whole career. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And now he anchors the National Security Report here on Action Radio. How much national security is enough? And now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
I just want to say the last sentence here before we get to Dr. Pry, and this is right from his article, but there is no evidence China needed reassuring or that strategic stability was imperiled. Nuclear strategic instability with China resulting from the contentious U.S. elections was all in General Milley's head. And that's as far as we got, sir. So feel free to recap, pick up where you want. This is a great article, and it leads into everything we're going to discuss in the second hour as far as the lovely and talented General Milley goes. Sir, good morning.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Greg. Yes, I think that this is probably at least the most important thing that happened last week in terms of national security. And I'm a little disappointed that even the conservative media haven't picked up on it enough and drilled down into the issue enough. Even many intelligent conservatives, you know, see the chief thing that's wrong here is General Milley, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, more or less taking over usurping the president's role in foreign policy and acting without his knowledge. And the statement, you know, about giving China warning before if we did decide to go to war against China, that we would give warning, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think that that's the most important thing by any means. I think, you know, I think the reaction to China, you know, the possibility of contributing to an accidental nuclear war because of the likely reaction that China's military and political leaders would take to that is by far more important than those other issues. You know, that, that Milley could actually have made it a self-fulfilling prophecy and brought on the very catastrophe that he allegedly was trying to save us from, and they're lionizing him. And beyond that, you know, the last third of the article, to just recap for those mm-hmm. who may be tuning in now, you know, what happened, you know, is in the book by Bob Woodward and Bob Costa, Peril, they allege that General Milley called China on the day before Halloween, on October 30th, because he was very concerned about China's reaction to the elections that were coming up, the Cold Civil War that was going on because of the contentious elections and that he was concerned about President Trump's mental stability. And in fact, prior to that phone call, allegedly had met with senior military officers on the Joint Chiefs of Staff to tell them not to let President Trump launch any nuclear weapons without General Milley's permission. So here also he's usurping the role of the President of the United States. And then called to China to give them assurances that the United States would not make a surprise nuclear attack or any kind of an attack on China, that the situation was stable, and that General Milley, because of his five-year relationship with General Li, his counterpart in China, their equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, that he would give them early warning. Then after the 2 days after the January 6th protests and occupation of the Capitol on January 8th, Milley again called General Li to assure him that America was not heading toward chaos and anarchy that could result in a nuclear surprise attack or other kind of an attack on China, that America was stable, 100% stable. That's the
bad word. And then, it keeps coming up in all the articles. Stable. What the hell do they mean by stable? Nothing makes us look more unstable than having a rogue general call China independently. You know, when Trump is talking peace, I mean, Trump did wonderful things with North Korea for the first time, talking to Kim Jong-un, as I call him, you know, but he was there. Hillary is the one that we all thought was going to go to nuclear war, or at least some kind of a war, because she talked about it. That was the danger. Hillary was the danger of war. The Democrats, Eric Trump said over the weekend, I don't mean to interrupt you, I'll be quick here, but I said this on the show earlier, Eric Trump said, whenever the Democrats look into a scandal, they find themselves. This is exactly what's going on. If they want to, they're talking about instability. This is the most unstable thing. I compared it to, General Yamamoto, or Admiral Yamamoto, calling up, was it Bradley or Marshall, you know, our Joint Chiefs of Staff in World War II, and said, guess what, we're coming, we're going to be attacking Pearl Harbor, you know, get ready. This is kind of the same kind of thing, you know, but they keep talking about stability.
Well, yes, exactly, and even worse, because you know, I'm really astonished that Milley must not have talked to any of the area experts or intelligence officers, people who have expertise on China. Now, you know, they're a totalitarian regime. They're a paranoid regime. They're going to always assume the worst. You know, if you call them up and give them assurances that you're not planning a surprise nuclear attack, especially when there was no basis for them to think that we were, they're going to assume the worst. When you say that America is 100% stable and giving them these assurances, you know, they're going to assume the worst. Just the opposite.
Yeah,
it's
really unstable.
And you can recount, and on top of that, General Milley has said a lot of the other things that are consistent with what the Democrat Party has said and the White House has said, you know, about how the U.S. military is deeply penetrated by racist people, white supremacists, white rage, that we need to root these people out. People like who have conservative and libertarian political views are potential domestic violent extremists who need to be rooted out of the military, you know, that sort of thing. And I think the most important part of my article is the third that you didn't get to in the end, because it's not just General Milley. This isn't an isolated case, but I'll take the liberty of reading that.
Oh, please do. I've saved the best for you. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, thank you. Yeah. You know, Democrats and their anti-nuclear political base often argue against the modernization of the U.S. nuclear deterrent because supposedly they fear accidental nuclear war. They want to ban U.S. ICBMs unilaterally to avoid accidental nuclear war. We've talked about that at great length on your program.
Yes, we
have.
They
oppose a new U.S. sea-launched cruise missile to avoid accidental nuclear war. They oppose the W-76-2 tactical nuclear warhead on SLBMs, that is sub-launched ballistic missiles, to avoid accidental nuclear war. And some oppose virtually any modernization of the U.S. nuclear triad to avoid arms racing that could lead to an accidental nuclear war. But they think how nuclear strategic stability must look to Russia, China, and North Korea when Democrats lie that there is a big problem with insurrectionists and white supremacists in the military, including an ICBM launch control facilities and aboard missile submarines, that the January 6th protests were an insurrection to overthrow the U.S. government. Could insurrectionists get the launch codes? That President Trump was a mentally unstable monster deserving multiple impeachments. Will equally insane Trump loyalists still within the military launch a surprise nuclear attack? That neither President Trump or President Biden should be entrusted with authority to launch nuclear missiles without a vote from Congress? Are U.S. presidents now so demented that even their own people don't trust them with nuclear weapons? This is what China, Russia, North Korea must be thinking, you know, when Democrats make these charges against our military and against our country. So how to start an accidental nuclear war that the Democrats say they're so afraid of? Well, keep talking crap like the above and keep heads like General Miley's on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So the article is really an indictment, not just of General Miley, but really of the whole woke movement that has captured the Democrat Party, of the Biden White House, of the whole Biden administration, because they are pushing these lines, as you frequently talk about on your show, and they have profound implications for our national security. They are putting the life of the nation at risk, all of our lives at risk, because these things you know, are far more likely to result in an accidental nuclear war, a miscalculation by Russia, China, or North Korea, our nuclear armed adversaries, than these specific programs that the Democrats are always crying about, you know, that are these technical programs. You know, they claim to be so scientifically sophisticated in finding technical arguments, specious technical arguments, fake technical arguments, to impose the modernization of our nuclear deterrent. But it's very obvious, you know, they don't appear to have the brains in their heads to realize, you know, that when you accuse the commander-in-chief of being insane, for example, and unstable, and not so that somebody like General Miley has to prevent him from launching nuclear missiles, okay, to oversee him, that is something that's far more egregious, far more dangerous, far more likely, you know, to provoke an adversary to misread our actions. You know, just today, as a matter of fact, we did a test of the, we had fired two Trident sub-launched ballistic missiles today, and these tests
they
worked this time.
Okay, good.
You know, and the UK Sun, I guess, or Allies, sort of underscored that they worked, you know, and in the headlines and in the opening paragraphs, they interpreted the tests as a signal to China, you know, that it had better watch out, better not be threatening, making any more threats against Taiwan and our allies in Australia, Japan, South Korea, and et cetera. Later in the in the article, they admit that, well, the tests are scheduled years ahead of time, and it wasn't political signaling, you know, but something like that, since we do routinely test ICBMs and SLBMs, construed by an adversary, you know, who thinks
but we do
that
one
we've
of those.
Got a madman in the White House, or madmen, white supremacists and racists in submarines and launch control facilities. You know, every time we do something like that, you know, if we persuade them, if they believe us, I shouldn't say us, if they believe the Democrats and the Biden administration, you know, about how half of America, you know, is insane, white supremacist, can't be trusted with nuclear weapons, you know, everything we do overseas in terms of our foreign policy, in terms of our military posture, in terms of tests and military exercises, becomes much, much more dangerous and could result in an accidental nuclear war.
You know, and sorry, I was trying to interrupt you earlier, but this word keeps coming up, accidental nuclear war. Well, what about a war on purpose? You know, it's like they've completely discounted the possibility that, as you and I have talked about several times, you know, there may be advantages to waging a nuclear war to either get it over with, you know, remove us as an enemy or you know, so that this isn't a problem. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not even forecasting it. I don't think China particularly cares right now about the United States, just because we're not as strong as we were under Trump and not as strong as we have been, you know, ever since World War II, when we were the dominant military power. I think we're probably in the least position to be a threat to China right now. But the point is that they never consider the possibility that that there would be a purposeful nuclear war. I mean, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor on purpose. You know, the attacks that have come, I mean, Hitler invaded Poland on purpose. You know, these weren't, there was no reason to do it other than the fact that they wanted to. This was a national policy. And if China decides that they want to take Taiwan, it's going to be on purpose. It's not going to be an accident.
And so this whole idea of perpetual accidents makes no sense to me.
Right. And the United States, which is the most benign, most humanitarian civilization that has ever mm-hmm. existed in history, we used the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki on purpose.
Yeah, that's
so,
true.
You know, but those arguments are too sophisticated for the left to get its head around. And in part, I wrote the article
mm-hmm.
aiming at the left and Democrats to explain to them on their own terms, because their biggest argument against U.S. nuclear weapons modernization is the boogeyman of accidental nuclear war. And so I threw it back in their faces, trying mm-hmm. to get them to think, you know, about what they're doing here. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, those arguments, however, are not arguments that the left finds acceptable. You know,
they don't care.
The only way a nuclear war could happen would be by accident and miscalculation, but they're completely wrong. And in fact, you know, since the Russians and Chinese and the North Koreans are much, their intelligence officers and their planners are realists. Well, maybe that's a mistake. They're paranoid realists. Okay, they have their vision of history shaped by their own bloody history, and they're much more inclined to see threats everywhere. And the very fact that the United States, for example, let's take that the point that you made. You know, Americans, given our much more peaceful history, would say, well, you know, under Biden, you know, we're militarily weak. You know, we're not planning. You know, we're on needles and pins right now over what the nuclear posture review is going to do to our nuclear deterrent. You know, is it going to reduce the size of our nuclear deterrent? And therefore, because we're on this downward trend as a military and economic power, we must be less of a threat to China and Russia and North Korea. And so they would be less inclined to launch a preemptive strike to take us out. But if you have a more suspicious reading of history, you can look at things like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example. And, you know, you can have world wars that happen because a nation is in decline and it's got it's more sensitive to the fact that its power is on the wane. And so they're willing to roll the dice to restore that power, you know, as the Austro-Hungarian Empire did, you know, rather than suffer the humiliation of the assassination of their archduke. You know, basically they took steps that began the First World War, you know. So it can happen both ways. You can have a nation like a Nazi Germany, you know, that is on an upward trend in terms of its growing power and might, that will decide to launch a nuclear war deliberately, not accidentally, or a country on a downward trend that, you know, to save itself, you know, would launch such a war. In fact, the Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor might be looked at that way. The whole beginning of World War II, because they were at a crossroads, you know, where we knew that they were dependent on U.S. natural resources, including oil and steel. And the embargoes on these war-making things to the Japanese, you know, left them with the alternative of rolling the dice, you know, to try to establish the Coast Asia prosperity sphere, you know, where they could become a dominant power, or submitting to the U.S. sanctions and basically fading away so that their dreams of empire, you know, would not happen. You know, they were trying to turn themselves into a large, great power, and we were in the way of that. So weakness doesn't necessarily mean, especially from the point of view of suspicious totalitarian powers, you know, weakness can actually make you more dangerous. You know, the wounded the wounded animal can be more dangerous than the one that isn't wounded and a point of decline. And when you put it all together with the fact, the self-condemnation, which I can't, well, yes, I can think of precedents. I mean, this is in other articles that I've written. Mm-hmm. You know, I've pointed out how this self-flagellation that we're engaged in from our universities and pseudo-intellectual class, from our mass media, you know, the book publishing industry, we were doing it, the Western civilization was doing exactly this kind of thing in the 1920s and 30s, and it contributed to the outbreak of World War II. Mm-hmm. You know, it convinced the fascists, the totalitarian powers, the communists, that the West was degenerate and weak and could be easily conquered. And it turned out that they were right when it came to France, and almost right when it came to Britain. You know, if it wasn't for Winston Churchill, you know, who mobilized the English language and sent it to war, Britain, a lot of the elites in Britain wanted to cave and surrender to the Nazis after the fall of France. You know, it was that personality and a handful of others surrounding Churchill who stopped it, you know. And they obviously miscalculated, the Japanese miscalculated where America was concerned too. You know, but one of their motives for going to war was a lot of their people, a dominant number of their people, you know, we have this, you know, thought that we were a corrupt civilization, a degenerate civilization that was only interested in materialism and good times. And that's why we had neglected our military. You know, they looked at the status of the U.S. military, you know, that we weren't building up our forces. We weren't preparing for a World War II. And we didn't have a Bushido tradition in our culture and society and thought that they could win. And we're basically this kind of thing, not just that General Miley is talking about, you know, but he is just a symptom of a much larger problem that you have often talked about on this show. You know, the political correctness, the woke view that America is a institutionally racist and corrupt, and you know, and that we've got all these white supremacists, you know, including in our military that we actually need to purge out of our military, according to the Democrat Party, and they're so afraid of the people that we needed to mobilize two army divisions in the aftermath of the January 6th, you know, to keep those racists down and keep them from overthrowing the government.
While they were overthrowing the government. See, this is the ultimate.
Yeah, while they were
again
overthrowing the government.
You know, they're the traitors. They're the coup. There actually was a coup that took place. I mean, I keep calling the Biden insurrection as a government still under investigation. There's an ongoing investigation. In fact, Friday we're going to have the results of the Arizona audit, and I'm hoping that they recall their Biden electors and turn them into proper Trump electors. That's going to be huge. But getting back to your specialty here, do you know, and I've been calling him General Milley, if it's pronounced Miley, then I should probably correct that, but you're in Washington, have you ever met him, had any contact with him or his staff or anything like that? Do you have any insights into him as a person from experience?
Yeah, I think it's General Miley. And no, Miley, I haven't met him personally, you know, but I mean, he is another example of you know, where Trump went wrong, where President Trump, unfortunately, mm-hmm. you know, just had such bad judgment when it came to personnel. And where the military is concerned, I think he had a romantic, because of because he had attended a military academy, that mm-hmm. he had a romanticized view of our military. And he really didn't understand, you know, that the military was divided, that especially under Obama, it had become mm-hmm. politicized, and we had all these political generals, because of course Miley was promoted to the position as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But
yeah,
President Trump,
yeah, I was wondering how he got there. And
there was no, you know, obviously not any gratitude or anything to that, mm-hmm. you know, to that. And it's amazing how, you know, Miley chastised, I think it was Mark Esper, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time. Remember the walk across the Lafayette Square, you know, when they were, after the protests, the violent mm-hmm. I should call them riots. They weren't just, but they were violent protests, violent demonstrations. You know, they were wanted to tear down statues, and they did set.
Oh, the church,
you know,
the famous church in Washington, St. John's.
The church on
like
fire that George Washington used to go to right across from the White House.
Yeah.
And so it was an act of solidarity. Defense Secretary Esper and Miley, you know, walked with President Trump across that square. You know, but afterwards, Miley and the other JCS chiefs pressed Esper to apologize, and they apologized for doing that with President Trump because that looked like the military was being politicized, right? and we should never do that.
Can't have that.
But what a double standard. What a double standard, you know. And also because President Trump was talking about the perfect legitimate use of the military, you know, to put down, you know, a left-wing insurrection that was, in fact, happening with Black Lives Matter and Antifa. Burning down our cities and killing lots of people. And because the local police departments and mayors who were also woke and supported those things weren't protecting the people and weren't protecting businesses, the president of the United States, as commander-in-chief, had a legal and constitutional obligation to provide for the common defense of Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, and if the local police weren't going to be allowed to do it, you know, he had to threaten these mayors and woke governors with bringing in the military to do it, perfectly legitimate thing, which has been done in the past. We fought a whole civil war, you know, used under the use of presidential authority along those lines, and had many other cases in our history where this was done, you know, including against labor riots and things like that during the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. But the position of Miley and of others on the Joint Chiefs of Staff was that was, oh, that was unacceptable. That was politicizing the military. That was an unconstitutional role for the military, which is a complete lie. But when the Democrats took power, not a whimper of protest, not one protest, but actually mobilizing two army divisions to supposedly protect Washington, D.C. from a non-existent threat. You know, posed by the Trump insurrectionists, so-called, you know, just ridiculous. I mean, you know, this is an example.
The mom-pop folks
who
walked into
the
Capitol. The
Obama administration.
Yeah.
This deeply politicized military that's dangerous to our Constitution. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish President Trump had cleaned house. Those people all needed to be fired. It was so obvious what needed to be done. I never understood it. I still don't understand it because there were many good generals, most of whom had been fired by Obama or had been or had resigned. You know, now the generals who showed that courage, who stood up to the Obama administration's policies, should have been rewarded by the president and brought back. They should have been in the JCS. And who knows, you know, the outcome. Certainly our country would be much more secure and better off than it is now. Because those guys, in addition to understand the Constitution, I think were much more competent generals than the crowd we've got now. We probably wouldn't have had the debacle in Afghanistan. Who knows? Maybe even President Trump would still be president. You know, if he had certainly.
Oh yeah, there's.
If he had brought in people who were loyal to the Constitution, you know, not necessarily loyal to him, but just to the Constitution. You know, he might still be president.
Well, I think if they'd gone after the vote fraud, apparently the way they did in 2016, because the Democrats tried to steal that election too. So that's what I've heard. But anyway, you mentioned Afghanistan. So there's a couple of theories I have. And I know when we got Claire Lopez, you know, on Thursdays, she's a big proponent of the, you know, they're incompetent, they're idiots philosophy. And I always tend to look for purposeful action first. And I'm curious how
you
do this. Because I don't think people are idiots. So they don't get that far by being complete idiots. They may have idiots on their staff, but the people in charge, they're dangerous. You know, I'm not saying they're not insane. I'm not saying they're not deranged. I'm not saying they're not, you know, avowed Marxists who hate this country, but I'm saying they're not stupid. And so Bagram, let's talk about Bagram and the weapons. And my two theories are with Bagram that the point, this is an Obama operation. The entire, it's not a debacle. It's a complete success. And so when Biden, in his mistaken, you know, verbiage, not knowing what he's talking about, says this is a complete success, he's parroting Obama. Like when he says Taliban, you know, the way Obama says Taliban. I know that Obama's words are coming out of Biden's mouth, and it is a complete success in terms of what they're doing. They had to close Bagram down because they wanted to get 100,000 Afghanis out to create another Muslim Sharia law enclave to destroy our country, just like they did with the Somalis in Minnesota. And so if Bagram was left open, that had a perimeter. You wouldn't get 100,000 Afghanis through that because we held that airport. We had a secure boundary. You could have gotten all the Americans out, but that wasn't the goal. See, the goal was to leave the Americans behind so we could go back to war. All right. That's why they left the weapons behind. So not only is this going to be a war against the Taliban, it's a war against the Taliban with our weapons. And so this is the greatest way to perpetuate the war by arming the enemy. And this is exactly what they've done. So now we have to go back. We have to rescue the Americans. We have to go, you know, fight the Taliban with you know, against our own weapons. So a lot of Americans are going to get killed for no reason because this never should have happened. But Bagram, if they had closed it and not funneled everything into Kabul, the Karsi airport, or whatever it's called, you know, did there just happen to be 100,000 Afghanis just waiting there, ready to go? How did that happen? No one's asked why they were all there. You know, how did we get 100,000 Afghanis out in like 2 days? All right. What, did they get invitations? Did Obama send people in ahead of time? Was that the plan? Or did the word go out and they all flocked to that airport? Because they couldn't have gone to Bagram. So giving up Bagram was essential for the resettlement of Afghani Sharia Muslims. Giving up the weapons was essential to arm the Taliban to build their nation, which they now have an Islamic fundamental republic, which is what Obama wanted. Okay, so he's rebuilt, you know, he's got a Sharia empire in Afghanistan now, 1,000 Afghanis here to destroy our country. This is a complete success as far as Obama's concerned, and that's why I think this is all purposeful. I don't think there's any incompetence here whatsoever. And he gave away the store when he said, this is a complete success. This is wonderful. People are like, how can you say that? That's how he can say it, because Obama told him it was a complete success. Great job, Joe. Thanks very much. Give up the airport. Give up the weapons. Everything's going according to plan. That's how I see it.
Right, and you know that I don't see it that way.
Oh, that's fine. That's why I have you on.
I don't have people agree with me. You know,
I can just say it myself.
Right, conservatives don't have to agree on everything.
Absolutely not.
But the way you see it is a way. It's interesting to me that you're not the only one who sees it that way. Of course, as you know.
Who else does? Give me something prominent.
Laura Logan. Laura Logan has no agenda. Okay.
Yeah.
Right, you probably saw her on Tucker. Very smart, you know. Mm-hmm.
She's hot too. She's
journalist.
Totally hot.
Totally
hot.
And
sorry,
when you talk to a lot of conservative journalists, you know, people who are very bright, you know, think logically, agree with that, and not just in terms of Afghanistan, but so many things going wrong. Why is America still vulnerable to EMP, for example? You know, why haven't we been able to get the grid protected against that? Or cyber warfare? How come the U.S. nuclear deterrent is being neglected and becoming obsolete? And you can find many, Jared Eichquist and, you know, many very intelligent, brilliant journalists and thinkers, you know, who have never served in government is usually the thing they have in common. Who believe in these conspiracy theories, you know, that it's an act
I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. I think it's a fact. I hate that term because you say conspiracy theory, you hate it. But the minute you say that, you discount everything
I say.
Could
be that stupid, right? Because you can't believe that anybody could be that stupid. And average Americans are inclined to believe that too. But just think about the fact that someone like Claire Lopez, who served in the CIA, and people like me, you know, who also have long service in the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. You know, my boss, Dr. Graham, who has a much longer service in government. When I was in elementary school, he was a young defense scientist, at the Starfish Prime nuclear test. And Dr. Graham said to me once, and I actually, there are times when I, too, you know, suspect that there are plots. I have mentioned and talked about on your show how I think, not necessarily that it's the bureaucracy, that our own people are traitors, but that the government has been penetrated by hostile foreign agents. Because we're such an open society, and so a lot of these things might not be just due to incompetence. So I have argued that, and I've argued that to Dr. Graham as well. And but he has a statement that I think is true, you know, about Washington, and it is you know, never attribute to a conspiracy that which can be explained by stupidity. You know, and that's the result of his long career and experience. So those of us who have served in government, in national security positions, tend to see these acts as results of incompetence and stupidity because we have seen it so many times before. And we know the people better than you who are in charge. And I've often said this too, that, you know, sometimes I wish it were true. I wish it were true that it was some kind of a brilliant Machiavellian conspiracy from the left that's happening, because if that were so, you know, it would be relatively easier to defeat something like that than it would be the alternative. You know, if we've got another President Trump, in order to defeat that, you just have to fire these people or send them to jail, you know, and prosecute them. Abolish certain agencies, you know, that are the heart of the conspiracy, and that could clean it up. That would solve the problem. But I think the problem is deeper than that. You know, I think the problem is a civilizational problem, you know, that's part of the long historical evolution about how we got here, part of which is the concentration of power in Washington, you know, and that even if you now there are good people you can bring in, but there are a lot more in the Washington bubble. You know, the people who have come out of our universities and have had their views corrupted and all the rest, and don't even have common sense anymore. You know, you couldn't even trust them. These people who believe in critical race theory, for example, who really believe in it, and then the notion of that the military is penetrated with white supremacy. A lot of people, they actually believe that, you know, and they're, in order to believe that, you have to basically believe your professors and be almost impervious to objective empirical evidence and have no ability to think critically anymore. And these are the kinds of people who are in charge, you know, and in the Washington bubble. It's not enough to put good people at the top when you've got whole bureaucracies, a whole culture of elites who run this country who have that kind of an attitude. So it's a much deeper problem, and it goes outside of Washington into our universities, you know, where the local leaders of our communities, people who sit on our school boards, you know, think like that. So the evidence of it not being a Machiavellian plot, but being a sort of, but being a consequence of a, call it stupidity disease, you know, that's a consequence of our corrupt educational institutions and our corrupt media. All of us go down, you know, how many times have you turned on the television and tried to watch entertainment, watch some movie, and they try to give you some turd pill of political correctness, you know, in the middle of most of us conservatives end up having to put up with that, you know, because they discover, Hollywood says, oh, here's a popular show, you know, like Star Trek. And then, you know, and then later revolutions of it, they try to feed us the political correctness lines through our favorite shows and things like that, you know, because they think that people who have traditional Judeo-Christian values are stupid, and we're the barbarians, and we need to be woke, if it's possible to make us woke, you know. I think they're giving up on us. I think they're giving up on the idea that they can make us woke, which is one of the reasons why they're resorting to violence, you know, including, and I think that when you, in effect, have a coup d'etat that deprives, you know, 85 million Americans of their right to vote, that's a form of political violence, you know.
I think it's a form of it. I think
that's
where this
is coming from. This is a much deeper problem, I think, and a harder problem to solve than the idea that Biden, the Obama administration, and holdovers from the Obama administration, you know, that a relative handful of people in Washington are are steering us the wrong way. You know, it's this is a much more formidable problem to solve. It's kind of at the roots of our it's at the roots of our civilization, because free systems, democratic systems, there's always been a struggle. You know, you can go back to the Athenians and the Peloponnesian War and see the struggles between the factions that existed then. You know, there's a tendency when you are, have a political system that's based on it's an adversarial system. You have factions or parties. That kind of a system tends to create not unity, but a division. And those domestic divisions are more serious to people than the threats from overseas, than the foreign threats. And it makes you vulnerable to them. You know, half the population ends up not really trusting the other half. You know, eventually, you know, it can become a civil war, in fact, when those factions have diametrically opposed values and hate each other so much. And that, it usually takes, you know, we're probably the longest lasting democracy, republic, you know, representative type system that's existed in history so far. You know, we've had a good
run,
200 years.
We can do so much better. Yeah. Let me,
I
want to jump in here for a second, because I want to let you go in just a little bit, but there's two points I want to make. The reason I don't like the characterization as of conspiracy theory is because people will dismiss, you know, and I don't see what's going on, dismiss, you know, me and my argument because of that. And I'm not picking on you. It's just, it's the idea, it's the characterization, which is very common. But the problem is that this isn't a conspiracy. Conspiracy implies illegal action. It implies that people are getting together, they're hiding, they're doing something illegal. That's a conspiracy to me. Okay. So, and the theory is that we think this is what they're doing. So what I think is happening is this is open. This is not a hidden conspiracy to do something illegal. I think these people think they're perfectly legal. I think they actually believe that Trump was a deranged person, even though he wasn't. I think they believe that they're acting in the best interest. They're trying to save the country, you know, from Americans, you know, because God knows we can't have those Americans running around in the United States. You know, they're going to ruin everything. They're going to ruin business as usual. They're going to ruin our wonderful agreements. They're going to ruin our kingdoms that we've developed here, from the Pentagon to the Justice Department, to the EPA, to energy, to all these different kingdoms that now exist in our country that we have to change and get rid of. If you ever want to do term limits, you need term limits on bureaucrats. I mean, I'd fire everybody over 30 and start over. That'd be my plan. Maybe 25. We'll see. But anyway, point being that it's not a conspiracy. This is the way these people are. They're open about it. We know the universities are Marxist. We know that General Milley, you know, was brought there as a political operative of Obama and the leftists. We know these things. We know the generals that were kicked out that were probably the greatest generals he's had. I think Petraeus comes to mind, you know, some of the others. But the thing is, this is not a conspiracy. This is open. This is right out there in front of everybody, and it's being allowed to happen. The only conspiracy is to suppress the information by not reporting it as much. But that's the fault of conservative journalists, except for folks like you mentioned, Laura Logan, you know, and some of the other people that are trying to bring this out. So that's my thought on the whole idea of conspiracy theory, if you want to react to that. And the other one, my last point, is the movie 7 Days in May. Speaking of Hollywood, Hollywood used to be the good guys. You know, Kirk Douglas, Burt Lancaster, Frederick March, a conspiracy of a general to take over the U.S. government. You must have seen that film somewhere along the way.
I wrote an article about it. For the Washington Times, called 7 Days in May for Real, you know, because I wanted to point out the parallels. Mm-hmm. Between, you know, that was what was happening to President Trump, that we were having a 7 days in May for real against President Trump. And I was one of the
first. Did we talk about that?
Yeah. I don't think we knew each other at the time. But that we
oh,
were,
send me the article. Let's talk about next week. this is a great topic.
That was one of the first. And I also pointed out the history of the making of that movie, you know, because this was actually one of the fantasies and fears of the left, the mm-hmm. people that produced the movie, made the movie, including Kirk Douglas, you know, mm-hmm. who had roots in the Communist Party, by the way. Douglas,
that's interesting.
You know,
he's Russian originally, right?
As an actor, but he was basically pro-communist. And the left's fear in the '60s, you know, was that there was going to be a an evil right-wing conspiracy, you know, led by militarists and super patriots, you know, to overthrow the benign left-leaning Democrat U.S. government. As you may recall, President Lyman in the movie, the reason for the coup d'etat is President Lyman is trying to have a treaty with the Soviet Union to ban or limit nuclear arms. And so the right-wing coup is going to result, you know, from arms control, you know, that was just beginning back in those days, the concept of arms control. And the reason the general, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, wants to overthrow the president is because he believes it's going to make the U.S. vulnerable to surprise nuclear attack, but from the Russians, who can't be trusted. So that's the motive. And the other part of the backstory is they were afraid that who was the commander of SAC at the time? He ran as
Obama back to the Stone Age, Curtis LeMay. Curtis LeMay?
Yes, Curtis LeMay, the General LeMay.
Yeah.
So the coup plotter in this mm-hmm. thing was actually supposed to be General LeMay. And part of my article is pointing out the irony that while that never happened and there had never been any kind of a right-wing threat to our constitutional republic from the right or from the military, you know, when it was finally happening from real, it was coming from the left.
Always.
And part of this reason is, and I think that this is this totalitarian mentality that you could see even back in the 60s, you know, mm-hmm. a tendency to not take seriously the disagreement that the left and right were having, conservatives and liberals were having over arms control, you know, that instead, you know, they would demonize us, and which is a way of dismissing and being stupid, to not have to contend with the other guy's view, to not talk to the other guy, to not come up with rational arguments why arms control, you know, is a good thing for the country. Instead, it's easier to say, oh, these people are just troglodytes and stupid and and super patriots, ultra-nationalists. They can't be listened to. We smarter people have to save them from themselves. And we have to be concerned that these people, you know, will be the violent ones and try to have a coup d'etat against us enlightened people. In my view, that's stupidity. Okay. You know, but
you just defined.
I'll respect not using the word conspiracy to describe your worldview on what's going on. But ultimately, it's an anti-intellectual.
I think I like conspiracy better than Andy.
Intellectual cowardice, you know, almost a sort of religion, you know, a religious approach to things where there are people who are enlightened, you know, and
are you talking about them,
they live
me.
In their own little bubble and feel so superior to everybody else.
Yeah.
To me, that's what we've got. And that's stupidity. And it goes back to the 60s. So, you know, it was so long ago. Yeah, I should be able to dig up that Washington Times article, 7 days in May for real, and and shoot you a
That'd
copy of it.
Yeah, I can look it up myself. I'm sure if it's still available, I'll find it. But the other films, if you remember, everyone, I think we did Hollywood. Did we do Hollywood? Because there's two other films that stand out. Failsafe with Henry Fonda talking about an actual nuclear attack. And there's the other, and of course, Dr. Strangelove. You know, stand out as the movies of their time of, you know, and it's interesting that you talk about, and when I think Eric Trump is absolutely right. He says, whenever the left looks into a conspiracy, they find themselves. And so the idea, it's almost like they're almost what you've just explained or justified is that the left stole the presidency in order to save this country from the president. You know, we can't have Donald Trump. We have to save America from Donald Trump. Therefore, it's okay to steal the election. That's fascinating. You have some great insights. I really like talking
to
you when I disagree.
It's okay for school boards to teach critical race theory to our children because they've got to save the children from us, their parents, you know, because we are troglodytes and we are unenlightened and we didn't go, you know, we don't have master's degrees in education from schools, you know, so that we... so that the average working parent isn't enlightened enough, you know, people, these churchgoers, you know, all of this is, so maybe in the end it is rooted in a vast conspiracy. You know, there were...
It's a collective conspiracy. They're all conspiring together.
Right.
Because General Milley has staff that didn't report to President Trump what he was doing. And the whole Pentagon, you know, how many people knew it? They say 20 people are on either end of these phone calls when they're being made between General
Milley. But it has a peculiar habit of happening to democracies across history, you know, which is why I don't consider it a conspiracy, or I don't consider it something that is... organized. I mean, sure, there are elements. You can go back to guys like, you know, John Dewey and the progressives and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But when you dig into their motives and all the rest and the dynamics of why it happened, I really think it's just one of the prices you pay for being a free system that operates on an adversarial principle. You know, the clash of ideas and the clash of
I'm not a clash of ideas.
You know,
we clash on ideas and we agree on things. Yeah. Okay.
And it works. It works when it's a clash of ideas. But eventually, factions turn into... George Washington didn't want there to be political parties, you know? He was afraid of political parties because he was an author. You know, he had studied, he knew the history. A lot of the anti-federalists were afraid, okay? You know, when you go into the anti-federalist arguments, they were afraid of a system like that because they had studied what had happened to Democratic Athens and Republican Rome. And, you know, as soon as you start having factions and parties arise, people start turning into sheeple. You know, they don't think for themselves anymore. They follow the party banner. They follow the party line. You know, the ideal thing is a clash of ideas, not even between parties, but just all individuals, you know.
Yeah,
But can that realistically... You know, we haven't had a free system yet that's worked that way. People do band together for political power, and eventually it corrupts the system, you know, so that you don't have, so that it isn't anymore a real, I mean, we all, how many times have we talked on this show and other scholars about how the quality of political thinking and discourse seems to have declined across the years from the founders, right? You started off before there were parties, before there were factions, just brilliant individuals talking about how can we make a good society, you know? And eventually you get faction and it degenerates into poster board politics without, you know, without very deep thinking anymore. And then the focus becomes on defeating the domestic enemy and the other side, which can turn into civil wars and coup d'etats, you know, because neither side, you know, ends up perceiving the other side as being, you know, credible intellectually. They stop talking to each other. They stop trying to reason. Now that hasn't happened.
It's happening now.
The conservatives, okay, it hasn't happened with the conservatives.
Well, that's the basis of cancel culture.
I mean, I think that's one of the failings. That's one of the reasons we have become so vulnerable because so many Republicans and conservatives think that what we are engaged in here is an intellectual debate with these guys, that if we can only make the right arguments, you know, give them enough facts, that they will change course.
That's a war. It's a political war.
Yeah.
I need to sum up. I have to let you go. Yeah. Okay. Now, this is fascinating, and like I say, it goes to so much of what we're talking about. The problems are huge. I don't know how to sum up everything. I just want to leave it here because you've got some incredible insights here. And if you want to talk about those movies next week, if not, that's fine, because who knows what will happen between now and next week. You know, we seem to be covering such a huge amount of ground.
More important things to talk about than the movie.
Well,
but
Miley's going to be on the stand. I think Miley's on the stand next Monday, if I remember. I know he's coming. He's going to be before Congress, so that should be funny. Just like Secretary of State, who is that dipstick? What's his name?
Tony Blinken.
Blinken, that's right. Yeah,
Anthony Blinken.
Anyway. Anthony Blinken, yeah. Oh, God, that was a disaster, too. All right, let me let you go. Otherwise, I won't, because we'll just keep talking, which is funny.
Okay,
but, we've covered some ground today. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, my friend. Greatly appreciate it. 7 days in May for real, Washington Times.
Yep. And if you have, oh, I was going to ask you, why, if you have anything on George Washington on his theory of political parties, I mean, I'll look that up myself, but if you have, you know, some articles that you're particularly fond of, let me know too, because I think that's one of the things I want to do is explore, you know, the elimination of political parties, you know, as a bill in Congress. So it's going to be interesting. All right, sir. Thank you again. Another incredible discussion.
Thank you. Right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye now. Dr. Peter Pry. Wow. Gene, any comments?
A lot of information. I'm really excited to see what's to come because there's got to be things going to be happening very soon. Well, there is with this week, Arizona, the election stuff coming out. And then you got to believe that, or I got to believe that. That's, you know, people are going to be, that we can't keep going the way we're going, that someone's got to start, I don't want to say being charged, but, you know, being, I don't know, blamed isn't a good word, but someone's got to take responsibility of what's gone on. It's like, why are the people in politics and the people higher up in government stuff, and that's included Billy and all those others, why do they think they're above the law? Because if this, we would have did something like they did, like Pelosi did, we would no longer have a job, and we would be like tarred and feathered and made to sound like this horrible person. And look what they did to Trump. None of it was true, but nobody's being held accountable for that either. And it's like,
he wanted to change the system, but he didn't fire everybody, you know, and Dr. Pryor is absolutely right. And we said the same thing on the show. He didn't fire anywhere near enough people. In fact, Mark Meadows, his chief of staff, said the same thing. They only fired the top people and figured that once a new person came in, the people underneath would follow along, but they don't. They follow their ideology. No. And whereas in business, you follow your job description, otherwise you get fired. But in government, you follow your ideology with what you came in with, and that you try and change the next administration rather than serve it. And that's the problem. All right, we're going to play our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece on the Articles of Confederation Part 2, and then we'll have about half an hour, a little less than half an hour left for the show. And so what you want to do, if you want to hop on the line now, 215-383-3832, we're open to pretty much anything, although I'm going to pick one of my four articles on General Miley and see if I can get the best one. I'll just continue into tomorrow. I'll figure that out probably tomorrow, and I'll be back. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. In our last episode, we covered the first three of the Articles of Confederation articles, and discovered that the states had a built-in firm league of friendship with each other, which I believe the Federalists thought got in the way of all their power being centered in the federal government and away from any state compacts. That's why the Constitution left this principle out. Article 4 carries this mutual state friendship even further when it starts out saying, "The better to secure and perpetuate mutual friendship and intercourse among the people of the different states in this union, the free inhabitants of each of these states, paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice excepted, shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of free citizens of the several states." This part of the Articles of Confederation wasn't put into the Constitution until after the Civil War with the 14th Amendment, and even then, there was no mutual state friendship pact included. Given the war between the Confederacy and the Union, this is understandable. Again, as with the ratification of the Constitution, there was to be isolation of the states from the states. Mutual friendship and intercourse among the people of the different states means trade and travel, something we were told was difficult under the Articles of Confederation, which I now believe was a lie in order to break any mutual state friendship, connection, agreement, support, or for any reason that might threaten federal supremacy in the new Constitution, without of course saying so openly. Also interesting is that Article 4 contains the phrase, "the free inhabitants of each of these states,
paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice accepted, which means that privileges and immunities, mutual friendship and intercourse, were for free people. Free meaning free of crime and dependence. This is fascinating because nowhere does the Constitution I know of single out paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice and openly make them unqualified for constitutional rights. The closest the Constitution comes is the Fifth Amendment, which says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, which means everyone, regardless of being paupers, vagabonds, or fugitives from justice, have all their rights automatically unless due process of law takes them away. However, the Articles of Confederation reverse the assumption that everyone has constitutional rights until denied by due process of law and declares that only free people are entitled to privileges and immunities in the Articles of Confederation before they get their rights. This was a real problem for the Articles of Confederation because there could be no presumption of innocence for people who weren't qualified for rights to begin with, and it violates the Declaration of Independence that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. The Constitution was right to change this article. However, there is one very interesting thing we can learn from this. Many, including me, do not believe that people on government welfare, not Social Security, Medicare, or pensions, but working-age people on welfare should not be able to vote because they are able to vote themselves more of other people's money, and politicians who give them more welfare can count on their vote. So in that respect, I believe the exclusion of paupers, as defined by my online dictionary as a recipient of government relief or public charity, from voting on other people's money would be correct. Should vagabonds have the right to vote? A vagabond is, by dictionary definition, a person who wanders from place to place without a home or job. This gives rise to the idea, in part, that the Constitution was written for white men with property, because they pay taxes and had a stake in the community. Although I've never seen anything like this written in any founding document, which means it probably is a modern prejudice against white men or people who have acquired property. Since it is necessary to have a physical address and lawful ID to vote, vagabonds might not be eligible to even register to vote. But that should not prevent the wandering from being able to vote. Wandering is not a crime. As for fugitives from justice, as in all discussions of the accused, it is of paramount and primary importance to always operate from the presumption of innocence, lest the innocent be denied life, liberty, and property. So fugitives could not be excluded from any constitutional right and should not have been in the exception to rights under the Articles of Confederation. Again, the Constitution got this right. Article 4 has two more clauses, one which is an extradition clause, which says, if any person guilty of or charged with treason, felony, or other high misdemeanor in any state shall flee from justice and be found in any of the United States, he shall, upon demand of the governor or executive power of the state from which he fled, be delivered up and removed to the state having jurisdiction of his offense. Sounds reasonable to me. And the last sentence of Article 4 says, full faith and credit shall be given in each of these states to the records, acts, and judicial proceedings of the courts and magistrates of every other state. And this made it into the Constitution again in Article 4, but it's slightly different. This is as far as I'll go with the Articles of Confederation for now, but I shall return as needed as we go through the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers, returning to both the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution as necessary. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it.
This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system.
Yeah, and the current projects as of today are to find a way to get Florida water to California farmers. And something I've been wanting to look into for a while is the idea of abolishing political parties for members of Congress. In other words, they have to give up their membership or not belong in the first place or give it up when you run. I don't mind political parties existing. Obviously, the free association, they have every right to do that. But as members of Congress, it becomes such a destructive force because it does. It eliminates the individual. It takes away the vote of pretty much everybody in Congress because they're either in the majority or the minority, and they have to vote with their party, or they don't get party campaign funds, they don't get party advertising, they don't get party anything. And the geldings, the GOP especially, is promoting their rhinos a lot of times over the real Republicans, although that seems to be changing now. So that's why I don't like political parties. Comment on that or anything else Dr. Price said before I get to probably the only article I think I'll be able to cover today, which is in the Federalist. Gene, what do you think?
You can go to the article. He said a lot of stuff. I'm still digesting it and processing it.
Listen to it again. That's why the podcast is so good. And, and many of the things that Dr. Pryor and I talked about, this is why I don't mind, discussing these things, they're in the articles that I have here. That, a lot of the questions I ask are issues that pertain to those articles, and it is quite fascinating. But this one kind of really sums it up for me. It's in the Federalist, and that's, FD List Media or something like that. I'm not sure where it is. It's a small print. But the Federalist is one of the better sources out there of independent political thought. And the title is Mark Milley, or I think it's Milley. There's two L's. All right. Sorry, Dr. Bry. I'm going to say Milley because I'm so used to it. Mark Milley deserves to be fired and court-martialed for his Afghanistan lies. This is Chairman of the Jeet's Choice of Staff, Mark Milley. He is an utter disgrace to his uniform, to our Constitution, and to the great United States and its amazing people. And I absolutely agree. This is Joy Pullman, J-O-Y-P-U-L-L-M-A-N-N, written August 18th. So it's last month, but it still absolutely applies. This guy's been around long enough that what he's doing today, what he's still doing is every bit as bad as what he's been doing. She says, Joe Biden's emergency Afghanistan press conference Monday accomplished exactly the opposite of instilling confidence in the American regime. No, it's not the same administration, regime, by neither promising accountability for this catastrophic failure nor releasing a plan to stabilize the situation. There's that word again, stabilize. Reassure our allies and recapture at least some deterrence against our watching enemies. This is a disaster with evil consequences that will reverberate long and far. The lack of accountability worsens the debacle by teaching Americans, our friends, and our foes that things this grossly incompetent will happen again. As Ben Domenech, D-O-M-E-N-E-C-H, Domenech pointed out Monday, whoever Biden doesn't fire, their performance Biden believes is acceptable. If this is acceptable, how can the American people possibly trust the NSA, that's the National Security Administration, the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, or the Pentagon? Even the most recent predictions were completely off. Once again, the intel community and expert class, I like that, the expert class, that's a great term, I'm going to use that again. The intel community and the expert class totally failed us, predicting this would take months and the Afghan army would fight. Okay, Gene, let me throw you on the spot here. In fact, anybody wants to call in, join us, please feel free. This is pretty much open discussion now. But the two theories, it's interesting that the folks that are, they say inside the Beltway that live around Washington, both Claire Lopez and Dr. Peter Pryor, both brilliant people, really subscribe to the idea that this is about stupidity. This is about incompetence. This is about, a total lack of understanding of the real issues. And I believe just the opposite. I think this is completely purposeful. And it's interesting, Dr. Price said, the people outside government, the Laura Logans, the other folks, Tucker Carlson's, me, I'm in good company, I think, see this as purposeful. and the reasons behind it. Once you see the reasons behind it, once you realize that closing Bagram had nothing to do with keeping our national security, keeping an airbase near China, keeping a very strategic place, keeping a place that we built, with billions of dollars, with 8-foot thick runways, had nothing to do with that. Everything to do with they had to close it to get the Afghanis out and make that look like that was the only way that was the plan that was it was a humanitarian mission. We had to get them out. We didn't have to get them out. They didn't even have to be at the airport. But that's why they closed Bagram, to funnel all the Afghanis into Karzai Airport, the one in downtown Kabul, and have 100,000 Afghanis and 5,000 Americans and a bunch of Americans left there. That to me is purposeful, leaving the weapons behind. Nobody leaves $85 billion in weapons behind if you don't plan to let them, the enemy, have them build the nation of their own using our weapons, create a Sharia law state that Claire Lopez pointed out is part of the Constitution in 2004 that our own State Department gave them. They gave them a Sharia law Constitution. They wrote it for them. God knows the goat herders can't always do it. They can't even speak their own language or they can't write it. They can't write or read their own language. So it's fascinating, all these different things. So this is a long question, but let me sum up, put it very simply. Do you think it's purposeful to evil intent or incompetent? Let me just sum it up that way, and stupid. Gene, where do you come down on this?
Well, really, Greg, I don't want to say either way what it – I just hope it's not incompetence, because if it's incompetence and think we have that, they think those are the best of the best that we have in the United States, we're just really hurting. And that's all I got to say. And I just can't believe someone would be so incompetent as to, leave all the stuff over there. And it's that, even though they say that, the helicopters were not in good shape anymore. Well, according to Trump, he was the one that had a lot of them go over there, and they were new. And so, and then they say, those guys, they won't know how to fix them. But yet, you can find anything on YouTube. So,
I found the manual for the Black Hawk helicopter in about 30 seconds.
I think, yeah. And so, the thing is, the FBI, the CIA. Mm-hmm. All those, everything, and I'm even believing a lot of the Pentagon, they're letting their emotions run. They're so, hatred for Trump, just so dislike of certain things that they can't see straight and make wise decisions. Because you've got to believe someone would have spoke up and said, no, this is not acceptable. But what do we have, a lot of sheep in all these places, and nobody
yes.
that's willing to stand up?
Nope.
I would hate
they
that
didn't.
To be the truth, but I'm thinking it is. It's even like with Biden and Kamala. Where's Kamala at the border? She went to a Howard football game, but she can't go to the border. Look at that mess down there. And they said, they're going to ship them back to Haiti. They're not going to ship them back to Haiti, they said, because they can't ship them back to Haiti. Those people haven't been living in Haiti. They started in Haiti, but they've been living in other countries since then. So what did they bring? All the diseases they brought here, the AIDS, the TB, the measles, but we're supposed to get the COVID shot? I think a lot of it is planned, because I just can't believe they can be that incompetent.
Yeah, I can't either. Yeah, okay. And you don't have to agree with me. I mean, in fact, nobody does. I mean, I don't have people on just to agree with me.
Trust me, I wouldn't if I don't.
Yeah, I know you wouldn't. I'm just saying this goes for callers too. Yeah. Yeah, Gene has no problem disagreeing with me, trust me. It's not an issue. But again, that's never a criteria for being on the show here. Now let me continue on, because this gets very interesting. Anyway, so he said, next part of the article, the right thing to do would be for Biden's generals to all resign so he doesn't have to. Well, I think they should all resign plus him, but that's a different story. Top of the list is Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, or Milley, depending on who you hear, who has spent the entirety of the Biden insurrection, as well as before it, playing politics instead of doing his job. Because of his lies and cowardice, Americans and Afghans have died, and our national security has taken a massive blow. Just juxtapose Milley's behavior against the increasingly alarming timeline from a July 30th, 2021 Inspector General report to Congress. This timeline below, which you're going to have to read the article, just of June and July shows Milley publicly acknowledging increasing Taliban control of Afghanistan as the military he leads prepared to leave. So they knew this was happening, right? He says the report grimly notes, again, 2 weeks ahead of the crisis in Kabul, the news coming out of Afghanistan this quarter has been bleak. The Taliban offensive that began early in the quarter accelerated in June and July. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified on June 23rd that the Taliban controlled about 81 districts. Less than a month later, on July 21st, he told reporters the group now controlled about half of Afghanistan's 419 districts, or more than twice as many as before. According to media reporting, the Taliban also controlled large stretches of multiple major highways and at least six international border crossings as this report went to press. The American propped up so-called Afghan army, the ANDSF, I've never heard that term, propped up army that fled Kabul in August has retaken some districts, and the Afghan government still controls all 34 provincial capitals, including Kabul. But from public reporting, the ANDSF appeared surprised and unready and is now on its back foot. Civilian casualties hit a record high in May and June, according to the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan. Continuing on, what has Milley done, been doing, as these events culminated in a spectacular national failure? Defying elected civilian control of the U.S. military, participating in top generals' decades of big lies to foment their greed at Americans' expense, demoralizing troops by endorsing the same racial extremism the Chinese Communist Party uses to destabilize the United States, and training military resources on American citizens over nonviolent political views. These are grounds for his resignation, firing, and prosecution. All right, looks like we got Bianca in the line. And let's see, get this going here. Let's get Gene, too. Feel free to join us anytime, Gene. Open discussion. Bianchi, what do you think so far, sir? Welcome to the show.
Well, I was going to make a comment on these refugees.
Okay.
You got refugees that's coming out of Central Africa.
Mm-hmm. Whereabouts?
And you've got Haitians.
Do you know from where? From where?
You got Central Africa coming from the Congo, Uganda.
Okay.
And also Haitians.
Mm-hmm.
Haitians should have went to Dominican Republic, which is right next door to them.
A prosperous Western Republic, you know, or democracy, I'm not sure which. But yeah, we talked about this before.
The Dominican Republic is a very resort, R-E-S-O-R-T, country.
Yeah,
you got
tourism.
You got Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
You got Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
So you mean to tell me that, unfortunately, if my house caught on fire,
mm-hmm.
or even the people in the Ida hurricane in New Orleans, they should go to France?
That's interesting, yeah. Or Quebec.
No. Is the United States going to be the dump for all these countries and people that's having these problems, unfortunately?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very simple. It's either purposeful or it's because of incompetence or because of some misplaced compassion that we have to give them a better life, which we certainly don't. They can make a better life in Haiti. We could go into – I mean, Trump could go into Haiti and negotiate huge deals for resources and industry and all kinds of things, just like he should do with El Salvador, just like he should do with Honduras and Guatemala, and get those – you know, allow those countries to actually experience freedom. There's no magic of freedom. Any country in the world can be as prosperous as the United States – as the United States should be, let me put it that way, because we're not right now, simply embracing freedom. Okay? But they're not.
Well, here's the thing. As I said before, you can't, if a refugee come here because of whatever, after that calamity is over, they should go back home. But I think they had some earthquakes in Venezuela about 10 years ago. And the people are still in the United States.
Yeah. Honduras had the same thing. They had an earthquake as well. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
You're
entitled to stay here. And, of course, that's not true. See, Americans refuse to act in their own interest. This is something I noticed, you know, coming here from Australia, that this country, the government policy, you know, in Australia, they have policy that it benefits Australians. Canadians, you know, of course, they're misguided now. They're much a socialist. But anyway, but there's a national pride. There's a national unity in the fact that, you know, there's no problem in doing things for the country. You know, Canada does things for Canadians. Australia does things for Australians. They don't have this misplaced belief that they have to justify, you know, their existence by doing all kinds of things for other people. This is the only country that does that, and it's very strange. it's a very strange phenomenon. I noticed this when I was a teenager, where the United States refuses to act in its own interest. Why would you bring in Haitians, you know, unless they came in through a lawful immigration policy like everybody else? And if they are here, and why would you bring them here temporarily anyway? You know, in no place that we don't bring Indians here if they, when they have an earthquake. You know, we don't bring, you know, earthquakes happen all over the world. Japan, I mean, do we bring Japanese in here when they have an earthquake? No. They, you know, we help them out. Or Indonesians, when Indonesia had a tsunami, massive tsunami, we went in, the military went in, we did rescue efforts, we helped these people incredibly, but we didn't bring them in here in huge amounts. There was no Indonesian resettlement, you know, into our country to overthrow our country, which is really what it's about. It's about overthrowing the country. It's about watering down American patriots. It's about getting people in here, as many as possible, who have no experience with freedom. That's what this is about. You'll notice the people that come in usually come from dictatorships, Haiti, Congo, Uganda. I don't know what the current state of Congo and Uganda's government, but Idi Amin used to run Uganda. It was a dictator. Congo probably had a share of dictators too. You never see Afghanistan, you know, Islamic fundamental dictatorship. You never see resettlements of people from a free country. Never. It's always the people. It's always brought in by the left and always to subvert our nation. That's the problem. That's why Venezuelans are still here.
And you know, you talk about Millie.
Mm-hmm.
You have people in the State Department that has pervy to his conversations on the phone.
They didn't say anything.
So why come they didn't report? Why come they didn't report of the activities that he was pulling off?
They were probably told not to. They were probably told not to. I'll tell you, they probably were told that, you know, this is your career, you know, on the line. If you go against us, you know, us being this independent kingdom of the Pentagon. You know, amongst other independent kingdoms, there's like warlords. You know, the warlords run this country. You know, you've got the head of the Justice Department. You've got the head of the Joint Chiefs. You've got the head of, you know, the FBI. You've got the head of EPA, you know, OSHA, things like that. These little kingdoms, you know, exist in our country, and we have to totally redo the bureaucracy. We've got to re-engineer. In fact, I wanted to get on with Gingrich. This is one of my long-term plans, was a country beyond bureaucracies, a form of government where there are no bureaucracies. We find a different way to do it. And I wanted to get Huckabee, and I wanted to get Gingrich, and this is my brainstorm day kind of thing. So as the show gets bigger and more popular, I want to bring these people together and say, let's start thinking of a government, because it's never been done before. Every government's always had bureaucrats. Well, they're the biggest enemy of the people, because they're independent of accountability. They do what they want. They do things in secret. They are the conspiracy, okay? You know, and they
yeah, and I'm
going to
end with this. They snooped in on Donald Trump. If Donald Trump was to order a pizza and requested American cheese, he would have been labeled a white supremacist.
Yeah, basically. Oh, yeah. But here's the thing, though. There was, because Trump was demonized, it became acceptable to work against him. Because Trump was impeached several times and the media kept saying, he's not one of us. He's not, you know, he's destabilizing the country. Millie felt it was okay to call this General Lee over in China, who I'm going to ask Claire about Thursday, because she probably knows, you know, a long detailed history of him. In fact, I've already asked her to talk about this guy. But because I like the personality, that's why I asked Dr. Pride, does he have personal experience with Millie? You know, and he knows people who, you know, have been around. I mean, he knows those generals and what their mentality is. But all the good ones were kicked out by Obama. Well, I mean, you know, Trump's master plan was totally stupid. But there's an article I have from the UK, which talks it from Daily Mail, which talks about how Trump was strategically misinformed. Okay, so this is organized. You know, he was strategically misinformed on COVID too. That's why he thinks ventilators were a good thing, even though they killed 97% of the people that were put on them. He thinks that vaccinations are a good thing, even though the virus has never been identified. It's actually the spike proteins, and the spike proteins are given to the people in the vaccines. And that's why they're creating the variants with the vaccine. They're spreading the disease with the vaccine. That's the coup. That's the crime. That's the treason. That's the conspiracy. You know, and it's a marketing campaign. And none of this stuff got to Trump because he was strategically misinformed about all these things. He had terrible advisors. He was listening to all the wrong people. If he ever comes back, if he could just spend 2 years getting rid of all the people from Obama to Clinton to Bush, get rid of all the globalists, get rid of all the traitors, get rid of all the people with a political ideology, and bring in patriots, totally replace the government, you know, with people that actually believe in the Constitution and will work there for a short time and go. You know, that's the overall thing we need to do. Anyway, I got more in the article here if you want to get into that. But Pianki, your reaction, feel free. Ooh, I stumped him. Okay, I'll continue on. This is back to our article here in The Federalist, defying elected civilian control of the military. And this is Joy. I'm going to get a quarter again so just people know who we're talking about. Joy Pullman, August 18th, 2021, in The Federalist, who says, civilian control of a military is a non-negotiable barrier against coups and dictatorships. Well, obviously, we have a coup and a dictatorship, so apparently that's not true anymore. She says it is a precondition for securing Americans' individual right to govern ourselves by reason and persuasion instead of force. That's what we do on the show here. Logic and reason. I keep saying that over and over again. This is how you get the emotion out. This is how you get your dependence on, quote, experts that are really government policy, you know, enforcers. All right. So he says, in the United States, we accomplish this by electing civilian executives to head military forces. All right. She says, this is why the president is called the commander-in-chief. Okay, I disagree with her there. The president's called commander-in-chief because Congress has given up their power to declare war. They now rely on presidents to do that. The president is not the commander-in-chief. We proved that in a previous show. The president is the president until called into the actual service of the United States, Article 2. Then the president becomes commander-in-chief when actually serving as commander-in-chief of the armed forces under a declared war. So that's wrong. So we'll talk to her about that later. Anyway, she says, Milley has established a track record of subverting his crucial safeguard against military dictatorship. Oh, this, that we even know this, is an alarming hint at more under the surface. As Dominic noted, this is D-O-M-E-N-E-C-H, noted on Fox News Primetime in June, General Milley was a major force undermining the constitutional authority of the President of the United States during the, he says, insurrectionary summer of 2020. Well, the insurrection were the Democrats and the deep state and the Republicans who went along with it. That was the insurrection. Just to make that clear. Back to the article. While American cities were literally on fire in the grip of a violent uprising with a body count and pervasive fear, Milley assumed for himself the role of preventing the president from using his lawful authority to bring peace and order to our communities. He made it his mission to deny the American people the lawful and constitutional aid of their own armed forces. In other words, the Insurrection Act could have been used by President Trump. He talked about it, of stopping, you know, all the riots of Antifa and Black Lives Matter in Portland and Chicago and all the different places they were. The president was going to do that. He didn't. And I think part of the reason was Milley took upon himself to make sure the military would not do that. He assumed command, you know, above the president and took over. That is a coup. Jean, Bianchi?
Yeah, you know, I can't imagine all the lives that could have been lost if something would have happened with what he did. I mean, look at how many lives have been lost now because of what he did in Afghanistan. And with, I mean, God knows how many people are still there because we mm-hmm. don't know.
And they don't care. That's the worst part.
Exactly.
They know,
and that's
and they
a
don't
bad
care.
Thing.
Well, when there was talks about using the Insurrection Act against the rioters, the looters, the thieves,
mm-hmm.
it was him that came out and said that the president should not do that or didn't have the stuff of that nature. Am I correct?
Say that again one more time. I was caught up on something else.
Wasn't it Milley that said that Trump could not use the U.S. military in order to put down the insurrections that was going on in your city?
Yeah, see, I don't know.
And looting?
That's a good question. I don't know. Gene, if you want to check that out real quick, we got about 2 minutes left. I don't know if he said that. It's very possible. We got a book here, Philip Rucker and Carol D. Leonig, that came out last summer, which, and they're quoted in the Washington Post as saying Milley began informally planning with other military leaders, strategizing how they would block Trump's order to use the military in a way they deemed dangerous or illegal. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So, according to the Washington Post, Milley also sought to stay close with Trump through the final months of his presidency out of concern that he might invoke the Insurrection Act and deploy active duty troops on America's streets. This is according to a book by Wall Street Journal reporter Michael Bender. So I think you're right. I don't have the quote, and I don't know how he exactly did it. Sure looks like he did it, according to this article. Gene can find whether he actually said that. I'd be curious. Another quote here on Tucker Carlson's show, July 15th, Chief of Staff Kash Patel, who I just saw on, I think it was One American News last night, said of Milley, he wants to, there's my 90-second warning, I'm sorry. He said he wants to create and has created a joint staff operation that is a pseudo-defense department all on its own, which he has hijacked the authority of the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States and to execute as he sees fit and that is in contravention of the law. So that's why I said he's built this little empire unto himself. In addition, as Carlson noted on the show, ironically, preserving a peace deal with the Taliban was the same justification that Mark Milley used later in 2020 to overrule Donald Trump's order to pull out of Afghanistan. Milley told the president it was only possible to remove half American forces there, not all. So he's overruling the president in Afghanistan. That's why we didn't get on May. I didn't know that. Anybody else? We got 40 seconds.
No,
we're going to pick this up tomorrow.
That.
Yeah, we're not done. Okay, don't worry about looking anything up at this point, Gene. We've only got about 30 seconds. And Pianchi's left us. I was going to get the last word from him. So, Gene, you got the last word.
I think we need to keep demanding answers, keep striving for the truth, and don't give up. Don't give up because, you know what, always love and kindness prevails evil, and there is a lot of evil right now in Washington, but just remember that. Love prevails, and so does, I think, love, but also doing the right thing.
Yeah. Okay. Let's end on that note. We'll pick this up tomorrow. We got a lot more things to talk about with General Milley and the whole problem with the military kingdom all into itself. Thank you all. Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Pianchi. Thank you to Dr. Pry. And this is Greg Pengles for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. And we'll be back tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock in the morning Central Time.
Have a good day.